Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. First, you'll hear Seth's interview with actor and comedian Jason Manzoukas, who also takes some podcast-exclusive questions backstage. Next up, Seth talks with MSNBC's Nicole Wallace, who also continues the conversation after the show.
Our guest is a very funny comedian and actor you know from such films as Neighbors and Dirty Grandpa and the shows Transparent and The League. He stars alongside Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler in The House, which is in theaters tomorrow. Please welcome back to the show, Jason Manzoukas, everybody! My friend.
Well, I did not get introduced with any of the awards that I've won.
Oh,
well, Lin-Manuel Miranda comes out, list of awards that he's won.
That's true.
Said nothing about any of my awards.
What were the awards that we overlooked the most?
Best beard in the biz?
That's an official
by
award.
By Gentleman's Beards magazine.
Okay, gotcha. That is. Best beard in the biz by Gentleman's Beards. That's great.
Yep, that's one of them.
Have you only won that once? Or?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Galifianakis wins every other year.
Oh, right. Oh, he took himself out of the running one year.
He did, yeah. Just to cut me some slack, because I was very melancholy about it.
How much beard maintenance are you doing these days?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. No, not much. I put a little bit of stuff in it, a little bit of oil in it. You know, you got to run a comb through it to get the mites out. Yeah, you guys get beard mites, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to, and it's true, you do have to, you have like a letter you have to give the airlines when you fly.
Oh, yeah.
To show that your mites are, they're like those dogs you bring.
Yes.
That put you in a good mood.
Yeah, you know,
they're support mites.
Have you been on a farm or anything like that? I have to say, I've got my beard mites, but I came to this country with them, and I'm leaving with them.
Gotcha.
I'm not trying to smuggle beard mites into your country.
What I come with, I'm leaving with.
I have had, this is true, I have had a guy come up when I was getting searched at the airport once, and surprise, surprise, I get searched randomly quite frequently. The guy was giving me the full-blown touch my dick pat down, and this other guy comes up to him and goes, make sure you check the beard. So the guy had to be like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
I think he was talking to himself.
Yeah. He was like, what life choices have I made that make me have to finger this guy's beard? And before you guys get weird about fingering a beard, it's totally cool and done all the time.
So you are, tell us, you play Frank in this movie.
Yes, I do.
And tell us a little bit about Frank.
Frank is, so Will and Amy are a suburban couple who've lost their daughter's college fund, can't put her through school, and if you can believe a world in which I am their degenerate gambling addicted friend,
yeah,
I am that guy.
That's the world. You talked last time you were here that you have played a lot of scumbag characters.
Yeah, we went through my IMDb and ranked all of my characters.
Yeah.
On the scumbag spectrum.
Where does Frank fall?
He falls kind of in the middle, you know, because he's not, there's no malice to him.
Yeah.
Like many of the characters I play, Rafi from The League, have like a real madness or malice to them. There is something crazy and off about them. Frank is like devastated and heartbroken.
Yeah.
But there is like some joy and there is like something nice about him. So you are rooting for him even though he is kind of a scumbag.
And you... It's all improvisers. It's all some of the funniest people you and I both know.
The bench is deep.
Bench is deep. There's one sort of outlier of somebody you don't know as much for comedy. Jeremy Renner's in the film.
Oh, yeah.
And how did Jeremy Renner hang?
Oh, he was great. He comes in as in the third act as, like, the bad guy, the villain, like, the biggest bad guy we face. And for a dude who's, like, walking onto a set full of, like, murderers, comedy murderers, he was, like, so game and so ready to hang, and we straight up lit that dude on fire. In my mind, I was like, well, yeah, and then a stuntman's gonna come in, and he was like, you know, in that way, he was like, yeah, no, let's do it. Let's do it. And I was like, no, this isn't what we're doing.
Because comedians only come up with ideas like lighting somebody on fire. Then they, like, get out of there.
Yeah, and then we sat there and watched him take after take be straight up lit on fire. I was like, we are melting Jeremy. We're going to melt Hawkeye like a candle. This is not a good look. There was one, it's in the outtakes, too, at the end of the movie. There's one take where they're like, they pour, like, whatever the flammable fluid is all over him. They're like, okay, everybody get out of here, get out of here. They light it on fire, and they go, action. And he's supposed to, like, wave it around, and it's getting bigger and bigger. This dude is such a badass. He goes, oh, no! Puts it out. I was like, are you kidding me? This dude's such a badass, just waving. The flames were like, we're okay, we're cool.
He's the flame whisperer.
Yeah.
You mentioned Rafi.
That's his new movie, The Flame Whisperer.
Yeah. There are a certain kind of fan that's very excited to see Rafi.
Those dudes up there.
Yeah. And Rafi is so such a degenerate guy.
Yeah.
Those fans maybe approach you in a different way.
Those people genuinely think when they are meeting me that they are meeting a monster.
Right.
No matter where we are, like in any environment, if I was in the public library, like looking through books, people would be like, oh, what? Rafi? Rafi, stop looking at books. You can't read. But I was in a men's room, in a public men's room recently. I hang out in men's rooms. It's cool. Don't worry about it. I'm in a public men's room the other day, washing my hands, and a guy walks in, clocks me in the mirror, and he goes, oh, boy, this guy's here? I guess we're all about to see his dick. I was like, I guess so. I don't know. They liked me. He was a fan.
I remain a fan as well, but you don't have to. Thank you.
You know, you can look at it anytime you want.
Thank you.
But once you've seen it, you can't unsee it, and it is gross.
Thank you for being here, buddy. I don't think we can top that. Always good to see you. Jason Manzoukas, everybody, the house for theater tomorrow.
Hey, this is Kevin from Late Night. We're backstage here with Jason Manzoukas. He's going to answer a few more questions in the dressing room here.
Hooray.
Yay.
Thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So Lin-Manuel Miranda is a
jerk.
Real jerk.
He's a bully.
You found out firsthand tonight, right?
He pantsed me in the hallway. Told me I was a nerd.
She's another guest on the show tonight. And you guys had actually met before.
Yeah. I knew about him. I remember In the Heights and then knew all about Hamilton. And I am a frequent guest on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast. And through a whole series of nonsense events, ended up creating a weird non-word catchphrase called Hey Nong Man that fans of that show say to each other. And at a certain point, I became aware of the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda listens to Comedy Bang Bang because he just tweeted Hey Nong Man to his entire Twitter base, many of whom overlap a lot with Comedy Bang Bang. So we're like, holy shit, this is crazy. I can't believe this is happening. And a lot of people were like, what is this? This is weird. And so then we met once at an SNL after party and have met a whole bunch of times subsequently. And every time Lin will tweet out a picture of the two of us and just the word Hey Nong Man. And it does cause like a real funny meltdown in like the comedy nerd community, which I appreciate.
That they love that.
It's a collision of worlds for them.
Yeah. They're listening to the same podcast that Lin is listening to.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. So you're from Massachusetts originally.
I am.
Right? Yeah.
Nahant, Massachusetts.
Great. And then you you did improv in college?
In college, yep. At Middlebury College, I joined a short form improv group, like mm-hmm. Games. Mm-hmm. And then I did that for many years. And then that group also spawned a smaller kind of long form improv group that focused more on the kind of improv that I then went on to do at UCB and Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and stuff like that.
Right. And you used to do shows with Seth and Amy Poehler, who's in the house
as
well.
Oh, yeah. I've been improvising with Amy for 15, 16 years at this point. And Seth, not as long, but, you know, frequently on the Sunday night UCB show is called ASCAT, and it would be, you know, a lot of SNL people, Seth, Lutz, you know, a whole bunch of people, Sudeikis, Dratch. Early on, you know, when I would, before I started performing in that show, when I would go see that show, you know, it would be McKay, Tina Fey, Dratch, a bunch of other writers. It would be like all the SNL kind of generation that is, you know, above me. And then as I got to be a more experienced performer, that it was like the my peer generation would be doing that Sunday night show. And it was great. I've done probably hundreds of shows with Seth.
Yeah. And you first started, I mean, what was your path from finding UCB and getting involved with improv when you first moved to New York? Did you ever do stand-up at all? Or
I never did stand-up, no. Having, like, found improv in college, I was pretty certain that was my thing, you know, in terms of, like, what I really kind of jived with, and sketch as well. I did a lot of sketch, both in college and at UCB. But those two, I just was much more interested in, like, I'm more interested in them on a process level and on an execution level. Like, on a process level, the idea of, like, writing and honing jokes seemed impossible to me. Like, doing the same act every night, like being a stand-up, that seemed really hard. And not really hard, but really not my thing. The idea that every night we get up, we're doing a different show from scratch, that night only, that's exciting and really kind of connects with how I like to perform and what my comedic point of view is. So I saw UCB do a show. They had just moved to New York, and they were performing out of the Red Room upstairs at KGB Bar. They didn't have a theater yet. They didn't have anything going on. They were just doing this one show, and it was mind-blowing. You know, it was, like, completely mind-blowing. And I saw that show, and at the end of the show, they announced that they were going to start teaching classes. And then I moved to New York. I was just visiting during that trip, and I moved to New York a couple months later, and I started taking classes a couple of months after that. So, you know, it was really, you know, for me, discovering that group was, you know, pivotal in my kind of, you know, growth in terms of finding the scene and the community that would then kind of flourish over the next 20 years. That's 20, it's 1998
kind of
at that
the
point.
Sweet spot of like being in there. Right?
So it really was like the beginning of a thing that would go on to be like a substantial comedy scene, which is pretty neat.
Another great improviser is Chris Gethard, who you've known for a very long time, right? And he has a show, and you were a guest on his show where you had to guess what was in
a dumpster. Yep.
Yeah. Can you kind of tell that story in terms of...
I will say this. This is one of the things that I love the most that I've almost ever done. And if you're listening to this now and you don't know what we're talking about, it's called One Man's Trash. It's on YouTube. Look it up and watch it before you even listen to what I'm about to... Oh, I won't even reveal anything, just in case. So keep listening, but then go and watch One Man's Trash on YouTube, the Chris Gethard show. And that was it. Gethard was basically like, you know what? This is the setup. We're going to wheel a dumpster out. Guess what's in the dumpster is the thing. You guys, it was me, myself, and Paul Scheer, who I do the podcast How Did This Get Made with, and who also is part of, like, you know, original UCB kind of world. And he and I both know Gethard, as Gethard is kind of like the generation below us. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of, in a way, and if you watch the episode, you'll see it, kind of we treat him like a little brother who we just kind of torture. And so he was like, this is the setup. You guys will try and guess. The audience will try and guess. People at home will call in and try and guess what's in the dumpster.
You know, full audience. There's like...
Oh, yeah. Full studio audience.
Yeah. 100 or 200. Oh, yeah. Like a ton of people.
A ton of weirdos just hanging out. People are guessing, but before we went on, Scheer was like, what do you want to do out there? And I was like, my goal is to try and not let anybody guess. I'm going to make Gethard's job as hard as possible, just because that's my feelings towards Gethard, is I always want to try and thwart whatever he wants to do. And so, and seize control. I was like, I'm going to try and seize control of this show, which successfully we did. And it's great. It's like an amazing piece of television. It's so hilarious. And when you finally see what's in the box, or in the dumpster rather, it's very rewarding.
It's super funny and so weird and crazy.
Yeah.
And
it's crazy. And it's also so fun to watch the episode and watch Chris just struggle against our insistence on not letting the show move forward. It's very funny.
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Come back again soon.
I very much would.
Great. Thanks, Jason.
I'm Amber Ruffin.
And I'm Jenny Hagel. Thank you so much for listening to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast.
But just one more thing. If you could, please subscribe and rate our podcast.
And review it.
And review it. And then call us and tell us you like us in person. Thank you so much.
White House Communications Director for President George W. Bush and was Senior Advisor on the McCain Presidential Campaign. She hosts Deadline, White House weekdays at 4 p.m. on MSNBC. Please welcome to the show Nicole Wallace, everybody. Hi, Nicole.
This is so cool.
I'm so happy to have you here.
Republicans don't get to places like this very often.
It was very nice to have. It's very hard to get Republicans to come to places like this.
So. We are all in witness protection.
So. Yeah, well, you, now, of course, you are, I should make it clear, you are anti-President Trump. You are a Republican.
Well, don't tell anybody that. Yeah, I was the Trump denier for a long time.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's good to know.
Is that a good? That doesn't help.
Do you? That's why Republicans don't come, is people applaud when you say
it.
Stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I get it, too. I'm always happy when one agrees to come. It's very hard to get, I will say, I don't know if you find this on your show.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get Republicans who support Trump to come on television.
Yeah. Well, I end up screaming at them for the whole hour, and then they call my husband and say, oh, God, I can't imagine being you. So I know what you mean. I know some of them.
Yeah.
I can help you with that if you want.
I would love that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bridge too far for most people I know, frankly, to support this president. It's not about Republicans and Democrats. It's sort of about reveling and blowing up everything that was normal. And I find being at MSNBC that I am more upset about him than most of the liberal people that work there because he destroyed something I cared about, the Republican Party.
Being the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And do you think, because again, it's early. It's early. And, you know, we've had this situation where Republicans are still winning these special elections.
Right.
But his approval ratings are pretty low. They're 36%. Do you feel like this is a long-term... Will this have long-term damage to the brand of being a Republican or the Republican Party?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how, you know, in politics, and I'm sure it's the same in television, the people in the middle of the crisis usually remain in denial the longest. So in politics, the people in the middle of the storm, you know, see the damage, you know, through rose-colored glasses. So I don't know that the people sort of governing under the banners, Republicans, understand how bad it is.
Now, you actually have sources within the White House. Do people within the White House, do they have a sense of how crazy everything is?
You know, I mean, listen, you cover politics as much as I do, and I always watch, and when you cut the same tape I cut, I always think that which is real is funny, and that which is funny is real. So, I mean, you see what I see, and it is the same on the inside as it appears. They're sort of the keepers of the Trump flame. The Bannon wing is how everyone talks about it. And then there are the professionals, people that are working in national security jobs that let people like me sleep at night because I know people like General Mattis and H.R. McMaster. So, I mean, the people that are there who are professionals, who cared about their reputation before they went in and who will likely have careers, depending on how it goes afterward, are interested in getting out information. I mean, you can't take away the serious parts of the job just because we have an unserious guy in the office. So, yeah, I mean, I do still talk to people in the White House.
And there are, so there are people, the people you mentioned, the Mattises, the McMasters, you do still have confidence that they are untarnished by what is happening, and they are sort of committed to our safety in a way that is still important.
I don't know if anyone gets out untarnished. I mean, I hope that men like that are. They're generals, and they're great, and I hope that he listens to them when push comes to shove. There's no evidence that he isn't yet, but I think that's something to watch.
Do you, you know, you did communications.
Yeah, what a lost art.
Yeah, so, and what is it, you know, because obviously I feel like there are a lot of people on the Trump communications team that often have to go out and sort of present this message to the press, and it's a very hard message to present because it is sort of BS and not true stuff.
Why? Yeah.
Were you ever put in that position where you knew you had to go out and sort of, well, not maybe just say a lie, but did you have to ever spin?
Not just
spin
the lie
something,
part?
But the spinning.
Well, I mean, listen, the Bush, I don't want to sugarcoat. I mean, only this presidency could make the Bush era look like, you know, the golden times.
Yeah.
So I don't want to sugarcoat anything, but he was so aware when things were bad. I mean, it wasn't like we had to go in and say, Mr. President, we have to go out and say that Iraq isn't going well or the vice president shot someone by mistake. I mean, we never had to spin him.
Yeah.
And so what's so crazy about this White House is they They don't talk to him for reasons that aren't clear to me. They go out and brief the press without talking to him. If you don't talk to him, what do you I mean, and we know what he's talking about, nothing.
Yeah.
So it is sort of like this Seinfeld meets the White House meets, you know, I mean, it is, the briefings are about nothing.
You mentioned that we, in what seems quaint now, the vice president shot his friend.
Yeah. It counted as a calamity.
It was a big deal. But is it true that you had to urge, because Vice President Cheney did not want to actually do press about it.
No.
But that was a thing that people had questions about. Because he shot his friend. How did you convince somebody
in the old days, Republicans would try to spend a week on a message, and the president had just given a State of the Union address, and we were trying to spend the week talking about switchgrass or some sort of renewable energy. Bush got very into that in 2005. And so we were going through the messages of the day on a Sunday afternoon, and my colleague Dan Bartlett said, "Oh, one more thing." And I said, "Oh, okay. What?" And he said, "Cheney shot somebody." And I was like, "Oh. Well, is everybody okay?" And he said, "No, he's in the hospital." And I said, was it a crime scene? No, they were hunting. And I said, "Okay, well, I didn't see that. Did we put it out?" And he said, nope, Cheney doesn't want to tell anybody. I said, he's the vice president. We should tell somebody.
Yeah.
And he said, what's the hunting magazine, like Guns and...
I don't know. I can pretend.
He wants to tell some outdoor magazine. I said, no, I mean, he has a press corps. We have to tell the press corps. So Monday, he didn't tell anyone Sunday. Monday came around, and our White House press secretary, Scott McClellan, was just pounded, because now there was a stakeout at the hospital. I mean, everyone knew he shot his friend.
Probably no questions about switchgrass day.
We were not driving our energy message. But we had to involve folks at the highest levels. And in those days, it was viewed as a way to move past a crisis to do an interview with a friendly outlet. So we suggested an interview for him, and there was a lot of yelling and screaming, and it felt... The vice president never really forgave me for making him do an interview about shooting his friend, but ultimately, we had to involve the president.
If his friend forgave him, he should forgive you. That's the only thing I would say.
I think so.
I want to... I'm fascinated, and he really is one of my dream guests. I'm fascinated by Sean Spicer's day-to-day.
Yeah.
Watching someone... that wasn't specifically your job, but that thing of presenting the message.
Yeah.
Do you have, because again, this is a job he chose, so I don't want to say sympathy, but do you at least have a sympathy for the difficulty of that job that he is given every day to go out and without any information have to answer
questions? No one should feel sorry for anyone in the White House. Those are the best jobs on the planet. They are, I mean, you literally have a badge that lets you walk onto this magnificent 18-acre complex, and you don't just work for the guy who's elected. I mean, the public is allowed to walk through it because it is the people's house. So no one should feel sorry for anybody that works in the White House. I can empathize with what it's like to deal with a rabid press corps, but he makes them angry by telling them nothing.
Yeah.
So I think that some of his problems are of his own creation. What's interesting to me about Sean, I know Sean. Sean is a good person. He has an impossible job, but no one makes him stay in it. And the fact that he doesn't have a red line that is on the other side of being undermined by the president or called fat by his colleagues, or, you know, I don't know where his line is, but they've crossed a lot of lines that I wouldn't have stayed there for.
Yeah. It is fascinating to watch every day. And the crazy thing is, 2 months from now, the lines you're talking about will also feel quaint, I feel like.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a director of the FBI, and even, the FBI director used to sort of be an untouchable job. You didn't attack the FBI director. And we now have a president who called him a crazy loon with a bunch of Russians who taunts him on Twitter the way, I don't know if you have kids, but kids taunting people on Twitter.
Kids taunt me.
Grown-ups taunt me, but you can't treat people on Twitter the way the president treats former officials in his government without getting kicked out of most private and public schools. I mean, he's a cyberbully. So just all the conduct is so unprecedented.
Well, I hope you'll come back and we can talk about it more. It's great to have you in the building.
Thank you so much,
and welcome to the building. Nicole Wallace, everybody. Deadline White House airs weekdays at 4 p.m. on MSNBC.
Hey, everybody, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Nicole Wallace, the host of Deadline White House on MSNBC. So this is a fairly new show.
Yeah.
What is your day like? You're on at 4 o'clock, but there's news breaking through your show, before your show, after your show.
So It's like shift work. So my shift usually starts very early in the morning. I work for the Today Show and Morning Joe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whatever you've read in to be ready for those shows is usually not the headline by 4 o'clock. So yeah. It's almost just this accelerated news cycle that, you know, that I think everybody is living in. And it's like drinking out of a fire hose for everybody working in the news business.
Right. The other thing I noticed about MSNBC hosts and analysts, they're always checking their phones during. I feel like years ago, people weren't allowed to do that. Yeah. And now half the show is the panel is just like scrolling through Twitter. Did you find that?
Well, too? I have a 5-year-old, so sometimes it's my nanny or my dog walker. but I do, yeah. And you know, if something breaks during your hour and you can shoot out a text to a White House source or, you know, a source on the Hill, and they answer you in your hour and you can respond. We did that once. Trump tweeted at Rosie O'Donnell and I texted Rosie O'Donnell and she responded and we were able to sort of have his attack and her response in the hour. So sort of the magic of this new technology.
It's fantastic. When do you consume your news? When do you, I mean, you're doing it all day, so, but do you have any sort of time to do it?
I am a total, I am a creature of morning TV, so I read everything when the papers fought. So the papers put up their stories for the next day's papers between like 9:30 and midnight.
Right.
So I have like a really hard time putting my phone down. Like I keep checking the home pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal until midnight, and I'll read everything that posts until midnight. And then if I'm on morning shows, mm-hmm. I'll read everything and sort of check through to any calls that I put out the night before. But I do most of my print reading in at night, and then and I'm not great at monitoring TV coverage. Is that bad to say?
No, people who work in cable news don't watch cable news.
Yeah. I don't know why. Why is that?
I think it's with chefs too. Chefs don't like make a big.
But I watch you guys because I also.
You don't have to say
no,
that.
No, but when I was at the White House, I watched the beginning of The View mm-hmm. because I thought like, oh my God, when Barbara Walters is mad, we're really screwed. You know, like I wanted like some touch mark outside of my little world of the White House press corps. You know, I was in a bubble with them. When you work in the White House press corps literally works on the complex. So I always wanted to watch something that was outside of my little bubble. And and now. Although it's not very helpful. I mean, you guys more often than not, I mean, you've now covered healthcare more today than I did in tonight's show. But I mean, you more often than not cut the same sound that we cut for a cable news show. I mean, you're much funnier about it. But I mean, I like to see, but it's the same things that are breaking through because it's all crazy.
It's all crazy. We cover it different ways. But yeah, it's the same tape. It's the same footage. We showed Trump talking about the healthcare bill when the House passed it. You guys have cut the same tape as we did. Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, the notion that a bill that he had a Rose Garden ceremony to celebrate, which is in terms of presidential celebrations, that's sort of a big one. He had a Rose Garden ceremony. He celebrated the bill and then he called it mean.
Right.
First of all, like a 4-year-old vocabulary. Second, a bill he celebrated in the Rose Garden. Mm-hmm. Third, showing, you know, what we were talking about before, that he'll undermine anyone and anything if that's what he feels in the moment. You know, absolutely. He's just untethered to anything that's come before, anything that he's experienced.
Right. Yeah, and you've worked in the world of politics, government, and it's just, it's really unprecedented. Us on the outside, it seems like it's unprecedented, but someone inside, you can tell just as easily or even more so.
It's not normal.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you're covering it. We're glad you're here. Thank you so much for being here, Nicole.
Thank you so much for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.